Germany in the mid-1930s looked to some Brits and other Westerners like a promising place. Some of them looked with intrigue at the new political party called the National Socialists, or Nazis, and the way they were standing up to the Babylonish hedonism and the cultural decadence that had come to dominate much of Germany during the days of the Weimar Republic. The newly empowered Nazis looked at all the drag shows and prostitution and risque entertainment that had become so prevalent in the cities of Germany, and they saw it as degeneracy. They saw it as something dangerous, and so the Nazis confronted it. They stood up to those experimental and decadent elements of culture, and they waged a concerted campaign to stamp them out and replace all of that with a disciplined and upright German society. And in the mid-1930s, some in Britain and the US and France and other Western nations took note of this. British and American and French societies were also experiencing some of the same kind of decadence. And so some in these countries looked at the Nazi Party's stance against it with some interest, sometimes even some admiration. Some from Britain and other countries even traveled to Germany around this time to get a closer look at the way the Nazis were confronting that cultural decadence and just to witness the other changes that were sweeping through Germany. Among these was Lord Rothermere. He was the owner of the very influential Daily Mail newspaper. He traveled to Germany several times in the 1930s and personally met with Adolf Hitler, the leader of the Nazi Party. And in his articles in the Daily Mail, this very influential British man, Lord Rothermere, would often praise the Nazis for standing up against what he called the degeneracy of German culture. And Rothermere would praise them for bringing order and discipline back to German society. Then there was also Edward VIII. He had been King of England until he abdicated, and then became known as the Duke of Windsor. But he was very impressed by the Nazi Party. He traveled to Germany, and he was apparently impressed by the way they were reviving national pride and standing up to decadence and communist influence and just claiming to restore order. There was also Wyndham Lewis. He was a British writer who visited Berlin shortly before the Nazis took power. And he described Berlin as, quote, Western Babylon. And Wyndham Lewis said he was encouraged to see the Nazis rising and to see their efforts to stand up against that Babylonish hedonism. He wrote, "The Berlin kiosks are calculated to enrage the moralist. They also leave the Nazis cold. This seems to me of great importance in estimating the Nazis." So it's clear that when Lord Rothermere and the Duke of Windsor and Wyndham Lewis visited Germany in the 1930s, they were impressed by a lot of what they saw sweeping through the nation. They admired the way the Nazis were standing up to cultural decay and saying that they would put a more upright and disciplined culture in place. And they are just a few of many British people who visited Germany around this time in the mid-1930s. It was really a hot destination for British tourists. In 1934 alone, there were around 360,000 Britons who traveled to Germany, so a pretty impressive number. But not all of these visitors were excited to see what the Nazis were doing. One British man named Reginald Joseph Mitchell was among those who traveled to Germany in the mid-30s. It was in 1934. And the primary emotion that Reginald Joseph Mitchell returned home with was alarm. He was not taken in by the hypocritical Puritanism of the Nazis or any other aspect of this newly empowered party. Instead, Reginald Joseph Mitchell, or R.J. Mitchell, as he was often called, he was only alarmed. He was distressed by the ambitions of the Nazis, which were already discernible for those willing to see it, even at that time. And R.J. Mitchell was particularly alarmed by the military buildup that the Nazis were carrying out. He recognized even at this early hour in 1934, that the Nazis' mushrooming military power could soon be turned against other nations, including his homeland, Great Britain. And he saw that Britain needed to actively prepare to defend itself. And R.J. Mitchell's vision ended up playing a significant role in Great Britain's survival in the war that erupted several years later. And his vision likely made a significant difference in the whole outcome of the war. So on this episode of The Sun Also Rises here on KPCG-FM, we will turn the spotlight on Reginald Joseph Mitchell, R.J. Mitchell, a man with rare vision and who translated that vision into a masterpiece of engineering that helped Britain push back against the darkness. RJ was born in Staffordshire, England in 1895. He was one of five children, and when he was a boy, he developed an interest in aviation. This was a new field of study at this time, a brand new technology, with mankind's first flight having happened when RJ was just 8 years old. So it was natural for a boy his age to be fascinated by flight. When he was little, he learned all he could about aircraft, and he and his brother would even build their own model planes out of bamboo and paper, and some of these apparently flew very well. RJ was also interested in pigeons when he was young, and he kept some as pets and would actually enter them into long-distance races. But he really didn't devote much time to recreation, from what we can tell. He left school at age 16 so that he could work at a local locomotive factory called Keir Stewart and Company. It wasn't quite aircraft that they were designing and building there, but trains were also fascinating. And RJ showed great talent at this job. He even designed and built his own lathe while working there. And at the same time that he was working long days in the firm's shop and later the drawing office, he was also attending night classes so that he could better understand mechanics, higher mathematics, and technical drawing. And he learned very quickly, and he was promoted accordingly. By his 21st birthday, RJ had distinguished himself as an outstanding designer and engineer. He was so outstanding that when he tried to enlist in Britain's military to fight in the First World War, he was refused, with the government saying that his civilian work was too important. So RJ kept working, and he kept climbing the ranks at the locomotive factory. And even as he was promoted, he made sure that he remained well acquainted with all of the work that his subordinates were doing. And this helped him to be much admired by his team. Here is his son, the late Gordon Mitchell, speaking in a 1996 documentary about his dad.
My father, right from the start, he prided himself that he was going to be able to, and he did, do every job that every man in the factory could do, be it at the bench or at the drawing office or anything else. And he did that. And that is why I think he had such great respect from everybody, because they knew they couldn't play him up, because they knew he could do what they were doing.
So RJ excelled at the locomotive factory, but throughout these years, his more passionate interest in aviation did not fade. It actually just kept growing stronger, and in 1917, at age 22, RJ was hired by a company in Southampton, Hampshire, called Supermarine Aviation Works. Supermarine was an aircraft manufacturer, so being able to work here was a long-held dream finally realized for R.J. Mitchell. And it was here that he really came into his own as an engineer, designing, developing, and testing brand new aircraft that were capable of feats that no previous machine ever built by man could do. During his first several years, he focused on seaplanes and flying boats, partly for use in Britain's Royal Air Force, or RAF, and the models that RJ developed, including the S-6B floatplane, set speed records and won various other awards for their remarkable innovation and performance. He even won the very prestigious Snyder Trophy, which broke the grip that the Italians had had for several years on this esteemed aviation award. So R.J. Mitchell was soaring during these years, in the 1920s and into the early 1930s. He was living out what seems to have been a childhood dream, to design aircraft, top-tier aircraft, and then to bring them to life as viable planes. And not just viable, but the best of their type in several cases. He was brilliant in math and had a blend of bold creativity and keen intuition that really put him in a league of his own. RJ was promoted to chief engineer of the Supermarine Aviation Works during this time, and he was winning prizes and earning all kinds of accolades. RJ was also married during these years, and he became a father. So everything seemed to be really cruising at altitude for R.J. Mitchell. But then in 1933, his health collapsed. He began feeling tired all the time and eventually was diagnosed with a vicious form of cancer. He underwent surgery that he barely survived, and this surgery did leave R.J. disabled. And the doctors told him that if the cancer returned, he probably wouldn't have many years to live. But RJ was able to hide his illness and disability for the most part from his colleagues, and it certainly didn't stop him. After a few months, he was able to get around again, and he made the decision to do some traveling in hopes that this would speed up his recovery. And one of the destinations that he visited was Germany. This was in 1934, the same year that the British writer Wyndham Lewis went to Germany and then returned home saying he was, you know, encouraged to see the Nazis rising and to see them confronting moral decay in the nation. It was around the same time that those other British men like Lord Rothermere and the Duke of Windsor visited Germany. And as I mentioned at the beginning, like Wyndham Lewis, these others were also impressed by the way the Nazis were standing up to cultural decadence and reviving national pride. So R.J. Mitchell visited Germany at this same time in 1934, just a year or so after the Nazis had come to power. But unlike these other men, R.J. was not impressed by the Nazis' hypocritical puritanism or anything else about their leadership. Instead, R.J. Mitchell was only alarmed by what he saw in Germany. During his trip, he had a chance meeting with a famous German aircraft designer named Willy Messerschmitt. And he also had some conversations with a few German pilots. The details of these meetings were never recorded, but we know that from them, RJ got a sense of just how serious the Germans were about rearming. You know, it had just been 15 years earlier that Germany had been made to disarm after it lost World War I. That disarmament was part of the terms of the Treaty of Versailles. Germany had been required to greatly reduce its military power, and it wasn't allowed to build up new military power. But here they were, 15 years on from the Treaty of Versailles, and Germany was not abiding by that treaty. Even before Hitler and the Nazis came to power, Germany had been secretly rearming, amassing more and more military power in the 20s and early 30s. And then after Hitler rose to power, that rearmament effort became massive and systematic. And during RJ's visit there, and during his talks with these German pilots and the aircraft designer, he got a sense of the real scale of Germany's planned rearmament and of the real ambition of the Germans under the Nazi Party. And RJ came to understand that a central pillar of Germany's rearmament was air power. The Treaty of Versailles actually banned Germany from having any air force at all. But the Germans had only disdain for that treaty. They despised it and wanted vengeance against it, so they were building a stunningly powerful Luftwaffe, or air force. Now, RJ was not alone in recognizing that Germany was rearming. British intelligence had been watching Germany, and the leaders of Britain knew, to a degree, what was happening. But many of the authorities refused to really accept the threat or to take it seriously. And that was true for many of the ordinary people in Britain, too. Not many of them went to the extreme of Wyndham Lewis and Lord Rothermere, you know, saying that the Nazis would be a good solution to Germany's problems and to Europe's problems. But there were many who refused to really accept the threat. They seemed to be in denial, and they didn't take it seriously, apparently hoping that it would come to nothing. And they just didn't have the stomach to confront it. And this is largely because World War I had just ended a decade and a half earlier. And the British had suffered immensely in that horrendous war. More than 800,000 of Britain's military personnel had been killed by World War I, which Germany had started. And then 70,000 of their civilians were killed as well. And there were many others wounded. So the memory of those horrors was still raw. Britain's economy had still not even fully recovered, even at this time in the mid-1930s, with very high unemployment rates and some other problems. And of course, they were also reeling from the Great Depression at this time. So the last thing many Brits wanted was to get involved in yet another war, and especially another war against the Germans. And as a result, many of them seemed to be kind of in denial about Germany rising up again. And others seemed to think that appeasing Germany, you know, letting the nation do what it wanted in mainland Europe, would mean Britain could stay out of the fight. So there was a bit of isolationist thinking among them and some strong non-interventionist views and just a lot of naivety and denial. But R.J. Mitchell did not fall into that dangerous line of reasoning. During his trip to Germany, he got a sense of the scale of the Air Force that the Germans were planning to build and of what they planned to do with that and with the rest of the military might that they were amassing. And he was distressed. He was alarmed. But RJ didn't just, you know, worry and fret. He took his distress and his alarm and he returned to Britain. And he set out trying to prepare his nation for the war, specifically for the air campaigns that he believed were coming for Britain soon. So he began working on a fighter. Even before his trip to Germany, Mitchell had tried to build a fighter for use by the British Air Force, the Royal Air Force. He wanted to build a fighter that was capable of flying at extremely high speeds, so he had designed one called the Type 224. That was supposed to fill this role. But the Type 224 had an opened cockpit, and it had bulky wings, and it was powered by the problematic Rolls-Royce Goshawk engine. So this Type 224 was a failure. It didn't meet the Air Ministry's performance expectations, especially in terms of speed. It was slow and draggy, and it just was not a cutting-edge fighter. So it had been a big failure for R.J. Mitchell and a big disappointment. And now, as he returned home from Germany, burning with urgency about the Nazis' air power and their military ambitions, he knew he needed to return to that project. But this time, he needed to make a fighter of true excellence. He needed to build a fighter for Great Britain that was lightning fast, deft, lethal and innovative, and that was capable of countering the cutting-edge warplanes that the Germans were developing. So Mitchell returned to the drawing board, literally in this case, and he and his team came up with a new design for a fighter that was first called the Type 300. This had an enclosed cockpit made of framed glass. It also had an elliptical wing shape, which minimized drag and maximized lift. For this unique wing shape, he worked with an aerodynamicist named Beverly Shenstone. And the elliptical shape actually resembled the wings of a seagull in flight. And it meant that the Type 300 could hit very high speeds, and it had remarkable maneuverability. And on each one of those wings, they mounted four 303 Browning machine guns. So the plane had a total of 8 machine guns, At a time when most fighters had only four or maybe six, this was an eight-gun fighter. And the elliptical wing shape allowed for the guns to be very spread out from each other. That meant the converging fire pattern made a very dense concentration of bullets at the set convergence range. And that's exactly what was required to take down the lightning-fast warplanes that the Germans were building. The Type 300 was also all metal. No more wooden frames and fabric-covered wings. This was all metal with flush-riveted, stress-skin construction. So that equated to a huge boost to its maneuverability and durability. Next, we come to the engine. RJ's Type 300 was built around a Rolls-Royce engine called the PV-12. The PV-12 was a massive improvement over the old Goshawk, both in terms of the cooling system and the power output. The PV-12 would eventually become very famous, and it would come to be called the Merlin. And this engine really put the Type 300 fighter in a class of its own. The plane had extraordinary climb rates and could hit speeds over 350 miles an hour. Not bad for just 30-some years after the very first plane had made its maiden flight in North Carolina. And then besides making the Type 300 fast, the Merlin engines were also uncannily responsive. They gave the Type 300 a level of smooth handling that most pilots had never experienced anything even close to before, especially at the kind of speeds that they were hitting. The Type 300 also had fully retractable landing gear. The entire wheel and strut assembly would fold up right into the wings. It was one of the first fighters to have such a system, and it gave it a very clean aerodynamic profile. This, of course, cut the drag way down and made this a truly cutting-edge warplane. And then R.J. Mitchell also gave a great deal of thought to the design of the cockpit. The visibility that pilots had while flying, and the ease with which they could access all the controls, it was far beyond what most planes of this era offered. RJ had actually started taking flying lessons himself around the same time that he was building the Type 300. After so many years of being fascinated by aviation, and after so many years of designing innovative planes, he wanted to be able to fly them himself. That was quite unusual for an engineer at RJ's level at this time, and it would have been especially difficult given the disability that he had as a result of his cancer and surgery. But he didn't let that stop him. He took lessons for the better part of a year, and then he got his pilot's license. And that may have made him particularly sympathetic to the needs of the pilot, more sympathetic and mindful than most aircraft designers were. And the Type 300's visibility and accessibility really boosted its combat effectiveness, and it made fighter pilots just fall in love with these planes. Besides all of this, the Type 300 was also engineered to be very easy to mass produce, and it was designed with future upgrades in mind. RJ knew that developments would come up, battlefield realities would change, enemies would adapt, and problems would arise that they couldn't currently see. He knew that there were unknown unknowns, so he did everything he could to make this fighter upgradable so that it could continue to evolve and meet the evolving battlefield dynamics. So the Type 300 was a masterpiece of aerodynamic excellence and firepower, and before long it came to be called the Spitfire. That was actually a name that R.J. Mitchell did not choose, and he wasn't very happy about it. Spitfire was the nickname that the chairman of Supermarine's parent company called his young daughter. This young girl was apparently very spirited and a little fiery, so her father affectionately called her Spitfire. And then when he came to see how spirited and fiery R.J. Mitchell's Type 300 fighter was, he gave it that same name. So RJ wasn't thrilled with the name. He thought the cutting-edge Type 300 should have been named something a little more aggressive. But that was its name, the Spitfire, or Supermarine Spitfire. And it was clear from the earliest test flights that this was no ordinary warplane. The first of those flights was in March of 1936, and many more followed as RJ and his team fine-tuned this masterpiece of engineering. And then in June of 1936, the Air Ministry of Britain was convinced. They were convinced that this was an extraordinary plane, and they ordered 310 Spitfires for use in the RAF. This was a massive success for RJ. In the Spitfire, his vision had been brought to life, and his country was recognizing the brilliance of his design, and they were preparing to use them to counter the air power and other power of Nazi Germany. So it was the achievement of a lifetime for him. But starting in early 1937, his health took a sharp turn for the worse. It became clear that his cancer had returned, and for a short time, he was able to keep working on the Spitfire and other aircraft, but he was only able to come into the office occasionally. And before long, he wasn't able to come in at all. And here's his son, Gordon, once again.
In early January, it became very, very obvious that the cancer had returned, and he went to a place in Vienna to see whether something could be done, but it was really quite useless, and he came back to die. He wrote a lot of letters to various people when he knew he was going to die, people in the Air Ministry and so on, all those involved in his work.
RJ wrote those letters because he wanted progress on the aircraft that he'd been working on to continue. He wanted his country to keep on preparing for the coming storm. So he wrote down the improvements that he wanted to make, but that he knew he wouldn't live to make. And he sent that instruction off to his team members. And then on June 11th of 1937, at the age of 42, Reginald Joseph Mitchell died. But the Spitfire lived on. And that first order of 310 units was only just the start. As the months continued, it was becoming glaringly clear, painfully clear, that Nazi Germany was on the warpath. And even though some of Britain's leaders still clung to a lot of naivety and isolationist kind of thinking, the nation was getting prepared for war. So the Air Ministry ordered hundreds more Spitfires, and then hundreds more, and eventually thousands more. Many of these were variants on R.J. Mitchell's original design. I mentioned that he had made the Spitfire adaptable and upgradable, and after his death, they were adapted and upgraded in numerous ways. There ended up being 20 major variants of the Supermarine Spitfire, and if you count the sub-variants, the number climbs to more than 50. More than 50 variations, some with more powerful engines, some with refined airframes, making them better for overseas flights, some optimized for very high altitudes, some tweaked to be reconnaissance planes. So there were many variations, and it wasn't just Great Britain and the Royal Air Force that took interest in the Spitfire. Canada also ordered them for its Air Force, as did Australia and New Zealand and South Africa and Greece and India and the Soviet Union. And the United States also borrowed over 100 Spitfires to use while it was trying to build its own fighters. So the potential of the Spitfire was easy for everyone to see. It was widely recognized as a crucial weapon to counter fascist darkness. And by the time the very last Spitfire rolled off the assembly line in 1948, a total of 20,351 Spitfire fighters had been built. 20,351. And R.J. Mitchell never lived to see the Spitfires in action, since he died in 1937, a couple of years before World War II erupted. But these warplanes did play a massive role in helping the Brits and their allies stand up to the Nazis. And they played a massive role in preventing the Nazis from transforming the world into a perverse fascist empire. In the summer of 1940, it became clear that R.J. Mitchell had been right about the Germans bringing their air force to Britain. The Germans at that time started carrying out air attacks against British shipping in the English Channel and against coastal radar stations. This was in preparation for what the Germans called Operation Sea Lion, a plan to invade Great Britain. They wanted to first gain air superiority and then make an amphibious invasion of Britain. So the Luftwaffe, led by Germany's lethal Messerschmitt Bf 109s, assaulted Britain for months on end. This came to be called the Battle of Britain. It started, as I said, on channel shipping and coastal radar, but soon the Germans were hitting Britain's airfields and its aircraft factories. And then they started bombing Britain's major cities. The Germans came at them with staggering fury and firepower. But the Spitfire had high-altitude performance that was even better than that of Germany's Bf 109s. Better agility, too. And they helped the Brits achieve air superiority in the Battle of Britain. And that meant Operation Sea Lion was never initiated. Adolf Hitler had to cancel his plan to invade Britain. It was after this landmark battle up in the skies that British Prime Minister Winston Churchill famously said, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few." Mr. Churchill was talking there mainly about the pilots for the Royal Air Force when he referred to the few. You know, the courageous pilots who had denied the Nazis the air superiority that they needed as a precursor to invasion. And a great many of these pilots were flying Spitfires, R.J. Mitchell's masterpiece. And there's no question that those few British pilots would have been far less effective had they been flying less excellent warplanes. In light of this famous Churchill quote, R.J. Mitchell has sometimes even been called the first of the few. The Spitfire also played a major role in the North Africa and Mediterranean campaigns. There, they outperformed both German and Italian fighters, and they provided crucial air cover for Allied forces in the Battle of El Alamein and also the Tunisian campaign. Later in the war, as Germany was upgrading its fighters, the Spitfires were also upgraded, just as RJ had intended, and they were able to keep pace. They provided escort to bombers and fighter sweeps over occupied parts of Europe and made those Allied efforts successful. The Spitfire was also key in establishing air dominance for the Allies before and during D-Day. They protected many Allied forces invading there and really secured the skies for the Allies, making a key difference in this game-changing campaign. And then there were the reconnaissance variants. These were photo recon Spitfires that flew at high altitudes, very high-speed missions with no weapons. And they were vital in gathering intelligence for several Allied advances and various Allied bombing missions, too. So the Spitfire was a game-changer on the battlefields and the skies above them. All of the love and care and insight that RJ had put into them and all of his brilliant innovations and masterful engineering really made it a history-altering warplane, a history-altering weapon to prevent evil from engulfing the world. Douglas Bader was one of the pilots with the Royal Air Force, or the RAF, and he flew RJ's masterpiece, and he said, "The Spitfire is the most marvelous fighter ever built. It's so easy to fly, it feels like part of you." Johnny Johnson was another RAF ace. He said, "The Spitfire was a perfect lady, quick on the controls, responsive, and utterly reliable in a scrap." Alan Deere was a pilot in New Zealand's Royal Air Force. He said, "The Spitfire was so responsive and so sweet to handle that I felt I'd been flying her for years." One of the French pilots who flew Spitfires was Pierre Klosterman. He said, "In the Spitfire, you felt you had wings of your own." And then I have one here from Corky Miller. He was one of the Americans who flew a Spitfire. He also ended up flying a lot of American fighters as well, and he had to admit that the Spitfire was the best. He said, "Aerobatics were a delight. Her qualities of flight were so marvelous, no more complicated to perform than to eat a piece of cake. I never derived as much pleasure in flying any fighter as the Spitfire. She made me feel comfortable in any attitude of flight. Now I gained some understanding of how the pilots in the Battle of Britain could form up repeatedly, day after day, exhausted, yet admirably succeed in their mission, and in the end, defeat the Luftwaffe. I confess that my Tomcats, Wildcats, Hellcats, and the Corsairs and Thunderbolt P-47s are beasts of burden compared to this thoroughbred, the Spitfire. She is analogous to an Arabian stallion. As for the landing, she was no more difficult than to down a dry martini." So quite an eloquent and effusive testimonial there from the American Corky Miller. And then Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding also spoke about RJ's fighter. He said, "The graceful Spitfire was the most beautiful piece of aviation engineering ever produced in this country." And then Mr. Dowding goes on to give credit to the engineer behind it. He said, "Had it not been for the magnificent work of R.J. Mitchell and his team, the outcome of the Battle of Britain might well have been very different." Another one here from a pilot named Jeffrey Quill. He loved the Spitfire a great deal, and he also loved the man behind it. He said, "R.J. Mitchell gave us an aircraft that not only won a battle, but may have won a war. He gave his life for it, and in doing so, gave Britain her life." Now, it's important to point out that R.J. Mitchell certainly wasn't the only Briton on the scene in the years between the World Wars who recognized the danger of the Nazi movement and made vital preparations to stand against it. There was also Robert Watson Watt. He was the main visionary behind radar technology, that radar technology that was so crucial to Allied success against the Nazis. There was also Sidney Cam, the aeronautical engineer who designed the famous Hawker Hurricane. Those were fighters that were also crucial to Britain's ability to stand against the Nazis, including in the Battle of Britain. And then there was also Mr. Henry Royce. He was the engineer behind the world-famous Rolls-Royce Company, and he was a perfectionist who poured the final years of his life into developing aircraft engines. His high-performance R engine laid the groundwork for the Merlin engine, that incredibly innovative liquid-cooled model that powered many of the fiercest British and American aircraft during World War II, including the Spitfire. And then more important than all of these was Winston Churchill. He was very much on the scene during the years between the World Wars, and he was writing and warning very famously about the dangers of what he saw rising in Germany. So R.J. Mitchell certainly wasn't alone, and Churchill's warning and vision were far more important and impacting than Mitchell's or anyone else's. And we have a free booklet all about Churchill's warning and God's hand in that and spiritual lessons that can be drawn from it too. It's called Winston S. Churchill, The Watchman. And if you take a look at the show notes for this episode, or if you go to thetrumpet.com, you can order your free copy of that powerful booklet there. So Winston Churchill was the primary visionary, without question, that God used to save Britain and the world from darkness. But the way R.J. Mitchell recognized the Nazi threat early and translated his alarm into a masterpiece of engineering, that meant Churchill had the firepower in place to stand against Nazi darkness. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of The Sun Also Rises here on KPCG-FM. Thanks very much to Mrs. Maggie Hilliker for suggesting this topic, and also to Willow Powell for research assistance. And we'll leave you today with one final thought from Pierre Klosterman. Behind every Spitfire was the genius of one man who would not live to see its glory. Mitchell's gift to the free world was priceless.